Welcome to Tuesday's edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. A lot to get to in today's show. Coming up in just a bit, historian Dr. Tom Easern takes us back to the Dakota Territory's Gilded Age when elite hunters roamed the prairies in private railway cars, some even outfitted with pianos. Plus, we'll visit a Texas pecan orchard where bats, not chemicals, are keeping pests in check. That and a lot more is ahead today on Main Street. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and we've long focused on the nation's opioid crisis, but there's another substance quietly taking even more lives, alcohol. And it's woven into our social lives and business culture, yet as we've reported here on Main Street, its long-term health toll is staggering. Today we hear from Pew's After the Fact broadcast, where host Dan LeDuc talks with researchers and physicians about how alcohol became America's most problematic drug and how we can start rethinking our relationship with it.
For any of us who drink alcohol, I think it's a good time for all of us to kind of pause and say, should I make some changes just for my overall health?
Welcome to After the Fact for the Pew Charitable Trusts. I'm Dan LeDuc. Have you noticed more mocktails on the menu at your local bar? Or maybe that beyond dry January, friends or family are drinking a little bit less? The data says so too. A Gallup poll this year reported that only 54% of Americans said they drink alcohol, the lowest percentage in nearly a century. Still, nearly 30 million people are estimated to have alcohol use disorder. It's a common, treatable condition that often goes unrecognized, but policymakers in many states are looking for ways to better address it. Francis McGaffey, a researcher from Pew's Substance Use Prevention and Treatment Initiative, joins us to explain.
Pew has been working in states on opioid use disorder for several years now. And more often, we were getting requests for help from state officials on addressing substance use more broadly. They were saying, yes, we have to improve our treatment for opioid use disorder, but that's not the only substance people in our state need help with. And then we looked at the data. There are way more alcohol-related deaths each year than opioid overdoses. And there's a large death toll from alcohol, and it's important that we address it.
We've been hearing so much about the opioid crisis that's facing this nation, and to hear that alcohol is even larger is very sobering, and I don't mean that to be a pun at all. So let's put some numbers to what you were just saying.
Each year, about 178,000 people die from excessive drinking. Some of these deaths are related to things like alcohol poisoning or a drunk driving accident, but most of them are actually from chronic diseases caused by long-term unhealthy alcohol use.
Alcohol is sort of an ingrained part of society in so many social settings, business settings. I mean, this is a nation that tried prohibition 100 years ago and then changed its mind about that. Where are we in that spectrum as a nation of looking at alcohol use?
Alcohol use is definitely normalized, right? It's very common to serve alcohol at business functions when we wouldn't be providing other types of drugs at those meetings.
Right.
But we are starting to understand better that alcohol is not without its risks. We're seeing more non-alcoholic options at bars and restaurants. We're seeing more people decide not to drink for health reasons. Mm-hmm. So we're starting to change our relationship with alcohol as a nation.
What are some guidelines for people trying to just sort of sort through all this?
So the first thing to understand is, what does unhealthy drinking look like? So heavy drinking is defined by how much you drink in a week. 15 or more drinks a week for men and 8 or more for women. And then there's binge drinking, and that's the number of drinks consumed in a single sitting. So that's 5 for men and 4 for women. Now, you can engage in those behaviors and not meet the clinical criteria for an alcohol use disorder. That's the point at which alcohol is playing a major role in someone's life. People are experiencing cravings. They try to stop, but they can't. They experience negative consequences, like maybe a DUI arrest, but still continue to drink. That's when we consider someone having an alcohol use disorder.
I know in previous conversations we've had about substance use disorders, there are proven medications, but only, what, 1 in 4 get those medications. What's the analogy on medications for people with alcohol use disorders?
It's a little different because there's no gold standard of care for alcohol use disorder. So there are 3 FDA-approved medications, naltrexone, alcamprazate, and disulfiram. Naltrexone is sometimes taken by individuals who don't want to stop drinking. People say that when they take naltrexone and have a drink, they're able to stop at just one, instead of having that urge to continue to 5 or 6 or more. And then it also can help people who choose not to drink to maintain their abstinence. Alcamprazate mainly supports people in maintaining the abstinence that they want. And then disulfiram's used less because it can be really unpleasant, which is the whole point. The way that medication works, if you take it and then you drink, you get really sick, vomiting and other unpleasant symptoms. So the idea is it has a deterrent effect, but we still know that not enough people are getting access to medications because in 2024, just 2.5% of all people with alcohol use disorder got a medication to treat it. And when you look at the availability of medication across the country, there's a lot of substance use treatment providers that don't even offer it.
There's a spectrum when it comes to determining the severity of unhealthy alcohol use. Dr. Elizabeth Salisbury Afshar is a professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. While she often treats patients that are on the more severe end of the spectrum, she shared more about some of the national trends on alcohol use.
So when we think about alcohol use and trends associated with alcohol use, I think there are kind of 2 main ways we look at it. We can look at different demographics, which groups of people are drinking at the highest rates or are most likely to develop the most problems associated with alcohol use. The second way is really to look at recent trends. We've really consistently seen that it's younger, highly educated white men who have the highest rates of both current drinking. They're likely to drink the most alcohol, whereas we see racially and ethnically minoritized women and those with lower educational levels actually tend to drink at the lowest consumption levels. When we look at trends over the past 5 years, mostly 18 to 29-year-olds, while that group has historically had the highest rates of drinking, over the last 5 years, we're seeing that they're drinking less. The most pronounced rise in alcohol use has actually been among women, especially those age 30 and older. They haven't anywhere near caught up to where men's drinking rates are. But so we look at it in both ways, right? Like both where we are point in time and also what shifts are we seeing in certain populations.
Those are the numbers. Do we have any sense of the why behind any of those numbers?
There are plenty of hypotheses, but trends are often highly dictated by a few things. One is availability. Mm-hmm. 2 is who's in your social network and sort of what the local social norms are. So just as an example, I mentioned I live in Wisconsin. I've also lived in Illinois and in Maryland. And I will tell you, access to alcohol looks really different in these 3 states. When we lived in Maryland, when we first got there, we were like, what do you mean you can't buy alcohol at your local pharmacy or in, you know, at the grocery store any time of day? This was a really new concept to us. Whereas in Wisconsin, I mean, you can buy alcohol almost anywhere, in a gas station, in a grocery store. We haven't increased our taxes since the 70s. And so a lot of it has to do with social norms within that particular, again, whoever's in your social network.
Does that make it a little more difficult for people to sort out how they should be using alcohol in a healthy way, if in fact there is a healthy way to do that?
For so long, alcohol was so normalized. And even for a little while, there was this idea that maybe a certain amount of red wine is really healthy. And we're seeing a shift based on our current understanding of the literature to really say, actually, probably no amount of alcohol is healthy. We're no longer recommending any alcohol for health benefit, recognizing that all alcohol has health risk. And so balancing that with social norms and often, you know, learned behaviors. If every time you go out with your friends, you start by having a drink, that's a learned behavior. And so if you're out with everybody else who's having a drink and you say, you know what, I'm not going to have a drink today. Many of us have probably been through this. There's a little bit of peer pressure, a little bit of like, why are you going against the grain? This is our thing. drinking. This is what we do. This is what's expected. And that can be hard.
As I understand it, some problems in self-awareness of how much is recommended. My idea of what one drink is might be different than what the government recommendations are for one drink. Can you walk us through a little bit of that?
The recommendations continue to change over time. Yeah. And I provide a lot of education, especially to primary care clinicians, and they often are not aware of these sort of current recommended drinking limits. Oftentimes I'll work with patients and I'll say, how much are you drinking? And they'll say, oh, 2 drinks a night. And I'll say, okay, what's in a drink? And they'll say, oh, I don't know, 2, 3, maybe 4 shots in a drink. You know, I'm just pouring it in there. And so when we say a standard drink in this context, what we're talking about is 1 12-ounce beer that's 5% alcohol content, 5 ounces of wine, which depending on the size of your wine glass, right, might be a half, might be a third, and 1 shot of spirits. So if somebody's having a quote double, that would be 2 drinks. These recommended upper limits are specifically for people who are not pregnant and those who are 21 or older. And I should note here that's men 64 and under, because men 65 and up, they also say no more than one standard drink per day. And the other thing I should say here is that these are U.S. recommendations. The World Health Organization now states specifically that there is no safe level of alcohol consumption based on this accumulating evidence that there's increased risk even at low levels of drinking.
There are some health conditions that can be exacerbated over the long term by alcohol use. What are we talking about?
Often when we think about the health outcomes associated with alcohol, we sort of categorize them into 2 general categories. 1 are acute risks. It might be, especially for older adults, falls, for all populations, motor vehicle accidents. We also see more traumas, often unwanted sexual experiences that may happen while intoxicated. We also see that acute alcohol intoxication can potentiate suicide and homicide, especially for people with underlying depression in particular. The other category, and this is one that we might not all know as much about, is really about the chronic or the long-term impacts of alcohol use. Even people without what we would call an alcohol use disorder have increased risk of developing things like liver disease, pancreatitis, a variety of cardiovascular conditions, including high blood pressure. We see lots of psychiatric comorbidities, so things like depression and anxiety. We also know that alcohol use contributes pretty significantly to insomnia, increases risk for developing dementia. And then there are now multiple types of cancers that we have very clearly found that more drinking leads to higher risk. And so literally, I almost think about it like from everywhere, from the mouth, the pharynx, the larynx, the esophagus, the colon, the rectum. So increases all of those types of cancer. And finally, female breast cancer. And I think that last one, I just want to say, is particularly concerning given that we're seeing increasing rates of breast cancer, we're seeing increasing rates of women drinking alcohol. And what we're seeing is that there's really no amount of alcohol use that's safe. It's what we call a dose-dependent relationship. So even small amounts of alcohol use can increase that risk, with, of course, more alcohol meaning more risk.
The patients that you're contending with who are at a difficult part of that spectrum of usage, do you find most of them come to you because they realize they may have an issue?
I work in a couple of settings. One is in the hospital. And so in the hospital setting, my team only gets consulted, meaning they ask us to come and talk to someone when there's usually a lot of concern. And so in the context as it relates to alcohol, it might be that somebody's there with a really severe withdrawal episode where they need medications to help them safely stop drinking. It may be that they're having signs of liver failure because of their alcohol use. They might even need a transplant. Mm-hmm. So in that setting, we're seeing typically a lot of health consequences. In the outpatient setting, it's more of an environment where people coming to us are asking for help with their alcohol use. Typically in that setting, people are coming in like, hey, yeah, I want to talk about this. This has become a problem for me. So we'll usually start by getting a sense at least of acute safety. So like, do we actually need to send you to the hospital to help you stop drinking if that's your goal, in a safe way? Because alcohol withdrawal can be life-threatening. It's rare, but it can. Then it's this conversation about, let's talk about what is the role of alcohol in your life? What are the good things about it? And sometimes people still have some good things about it. That's what makes it hard to give up. And then what are the bad things about it? And kind of where are you in that balancing act? And then talking about what kind of goals do you have right now? Is your goal to stop completely? Is your goal to be able to reduce use? What is that going to look like? What resources are available? And do you want to try? And we kind of build a plan based on that person and where they are in that moment. And that plan can be adjusted based on how things go.
Are there some systemic symptoms that you can apply to your evaluation of someone, whether it's an alcohol use disorder or other substance use disorders?
Clinically, when we think about making a formal diagnosis, we use something called the DSM-5, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. It's basically sort of any mental health or substance use diagnosis gives us guidance for the symptoms we should be assessing on. There are 11 symptoms. So whether we're talking about opioid use disorder, alcohol use disorder, cocaine use, like so on and so forth, it's the same 11 symptoms. Mm. And we're really looking at in the last year, how many of these symptoms have you had? And if it's two or three of the symptoms, then it's a mild use disorder. Four to five is a moderate, and six or more is severe. And then those symptoms loosely fall into three categories. The first one's really about a sense of loss of control as it relates in this case to alcohol, but again, could apply to any substance. So you're spending a lot of time trying to get the substance or trying to recover, like from a hangover, for example. The second is around social challenges and physical risks associated with use. So this might be, I lost my job, or I'm not showing up to work on time, might be interpersonal problems. And then the third category is physical dependence. So this idea of tolerance and then withdrawal. So now if I have a day when I don't drink, I actually feel really sick. I need alcohol to feel normal. And that's kind of just the first part of the assessment, because then the rest of it really goes on to look at, okay, what's going on in your life right now? You know, what types of services have you tried in the past? What types of services, again, are even available to you? Someone without insurance is often going to have many fewer options than someone with health insurance. But we really try to create a plan that makes sense for them and where they are in their lives. And again, as things change, we can change the plan.
I'm guessing a lot of listeners might wonder also, we haven't talked about Alcoholics Anonymous, which has always been out there as a place where people sometimes turn when they're asking themselves these questions about their alcohol use. That is a non-medical approach. How does it fit into the spectrum of available care?
Alcoholics Anonymous is one form of mutual aid, and there are many. Loosely defined, mutual aid means a group of people. Typically, it's not a paid, like something you pay for, but it's a group of people who identify around having sort of a similar condition who are supporting one another. I have patients who have had tremendous benefit from participating in AA, and I've had patients who really find it not desirable for a number of reasons. So I think it's a really important part of one of the many resources we have to support people who are struggling with their alcohol use.
From the way you describe it, I mean, I can see where some people might even find going to a physician to be almost an easier approach. I have something that's physically a problem, and I'm going to go talk to my doctor about it.
I would like to think so. And I think for some folks, that's 100% true. You know, the medical systems that we have not always been the safest place or the most welcoming to all individuals. The reality is, you know, in my community-based work, I also know a lot of people who would prefer to avoid the medical infrastructure altogether. The other thing I just want to acknowledge is that most people, and especially if we think about this full spectrum of alcohol use disorder, so mild just being a couple of those symptoms, in the past year to more severe use disorders, if we look at the totality of folks who would qualify as having an alcohol use disorder, about 70% of them recover without ever going to any formal treatment, no form of mutual aid, right? So this looks, again, really different for people. This is sometimes referred to in the literature as natural recovery. I think it's important to not assume that everybody either needs to go to the doctor or needs to go to AA or needs to go to formal treatment, but that there's just a ton of variability in there, and that there is that 30% of the population with some form of alcohol use disorder who are really going to probably struggle without more formal intervention. And that often it takes a few tries of trying different things. It could be medications, it could be counseling, it could be AA, it could be another form of mutual aid or peer support. There's no one size fits all, and that is okay.
I want to stick to the 70%. Are you saying that some folks might say, okay, I've got a concern here and I'm going to work on it and cut back?
Yeah, I think it's a mix. And this is, I'm speaking from experience. I haven't seen this research to be able to describe all the ways. A couple things I see really commonly. One is that especially when people are younger in their 20s, for example, when alcohol use is more prevalent, many of us have more robust social calendars. Sure. In that era of our lives. As we age, you know, maybe your life circumstances change. Maybe you have children or you take on other caregiving duties. You may work different types of jobs, right? As these life circumstances shift, people just make different choices. The other thing, and this comes more from my clinical work that I see a lot, is that people's alcohol or even other substance use can really start to feel a little bit out of control when they're going through really hard periods in their life. There's a loss of a loved one or a loss of a job, right? Or these sort of social circumstances shift for them. Alcohol becomes a coping mechanism and something that at least in the short term seems to help. And then in the long term can be causing other problems. And then maybe let's say they get a job or they go to grief counseling, right? Not even focused on alcohol, but they sort of are able to have some shift in their circumstances that then makes alcohol not feel as necessary.
If someone's listening and wondering about themselves, wondering about a dear one who may or may not be facing some of these issues, what are some ways to think about it, talk about it, and evaluate yourself or someone you love and make some decisions about whether something should be done?
I think that for any of us who drink alcohol, based on the totality of the literature, this is a good time to kind of pause and say, should I make some changes? Even if I'm not having problems in my day-to-day life, given our understanding that it increases risk of cancer and high blood pressure and so many negative health impacts, I think it's a good time for all of us to kind of pause and say, should I make some changes just for my overall health? There are lots of ways that you can either work on your own or with a counselor or with a physician to start to make a plan around what that reduction might look like. My biggest tips are to be specific. So picking a specific limit, saying, okay, my goal is to only drink two nights a week. And on those two nights, I'm going to have X amount of drinks using the standard drink that we talked about earlier. If you try that and you're able to accomplish it, that's amazing. Now, anybody who's ever made a diet or exercise plan knows that we're rarely able to do it 100%, but if you can do it 80%, that's pretty darn good. If you're trying to make those changes or you see a loved one trying to make those changes and they are really struggling, they're saying, I'm only going to drink two nights a week and I'm going to drink this amount, and they're going way above that. That's often a time where we say, hey, look, I really care about you. I've noticed that you're trying to make these really hard changes and it seems like it's really hard. Can I be helpful in any way? Would it be helpful if I look at other resources? Really coming to the conversation from a place of curiosity and from a place of concern typically goes much better. We've probably all seen those like TV style, like interventions where everybody, those rarely go well. And so really, I think trying to approach people from a place of concern, love, and curiosity goes best. The other thing I would say is that if you have someone in your life that you know is trying to cut back on drinking or trying not to drink, I think it's really hard for people to be often around other folks who are drinking. And so even if you say, I'm just going to not drink with you tonight because I know you're working on not drinking, I think it's better for my health too, that can be super helpful and just lets people know that you're on their side and in their corner and seeing them. And I don't think that there's a singular way that everybody's going to sort of find their own path to wellness, but the goal is that folks know that there are many ways.
The good news is we know what works. We know that healthcare providers having conversations with patients about their alcohol use, that alone can help some people cut back. Treatment systems can help people struggling with these issues. We know that there are medications that work, and it's important that we make sure that those high quality services are actually accessible to people.
Thanks for listening. If you're curious about your own alcohol consumption, look at Check Your Drinking. It's a tool created by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. We have a link to it and more information on this at pew.org/afterthefact. For the Pew Charitable Trusts, I'm Dan LaDuke, and this is After the Fact.
You've been listening to a selection from Pew's After the Fact podcast, America's Most Problematic Drug, Alcohol. You can hear the full conversation and explore resources, including the CDC's Check Your Drinking tool, at pew.org/afterthefact. Still to come on Main Street, waterfowling in Dakota Territory in the Gilded Age, and bats take the night shift at a Texas pecan orchard and will be inside the fight over critical minerals on indigenous lands. That's all ahead. Stay with us. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. And in this Plainspoke essay from historian Dr. Tom Ezern, we travel back to the Gilded Age, a time when Dakota Territory's wetlands lured hunters from across the country. Some came from nearby towns, others in luxury railway coaches, complete with porters, pianos, and fine china. It was a spectacle of class, sport, and style, and a glimpse into the nation's gilded ambitions.
The waterfowl hunters of Dakota Territory were mainly townsmen who ventured into the countryside and returned with ducks and geese to distribute among neighbors. These middling folk shared the venatic landscape with a more effete and elite class of hunters who traveled in style. The Montana State Library preserves a suite of photos of a railway coach pulled aside on the Northern Pacific at Crystal Springs. Side and rear platforms hung heavy with game, male and female excursionists standing alongside. With benefit of newspaper research, I can identify these photos more specifically. The University of Michigan Library holds another photo, identified as the railway coach City of Saginaw on its return to its eponymous city from Dawson, Dakota Territory, in 1889. A similar scene, including travelers and an abundance of game, with an apron-clad cook on the back step. I can tell you more about this one, too. In August 1878, the Bismarck Tribune, under the title A Well-Fixed Hunting Party, gave advance notice of the expected arrival of the private railway coach, City of Worcester, the traveling headquarters of Jerome Marble, when he was not at home in his Second Empire residence in Worcester, Massachusetts. Marble was, in fact, the developer of a fleet of luxurious excursion cars. His company was called the Worcester Excursion Car Company. He bought this particular coach following its exhibit at the 1876 Centennial Exposition in Fairmount Park, Philadelphia, and adapted it as a hunting car. The Worcester accommodated 20 travelers and all the needs of hunters, their spouses, and children. It came with a porter and a cook. On October 3rd, the Jamestown Alert, a noted arrival of the Worcester in Jimtown, where the men rented wagons and mules with drivers to convey them to Spiritwood and Grasshopper Lakes. The ladies remain in the car at this place, the reporter writes. A week later, he reports the car's departure for Crystal Springs, where the photos were taken. The hunters had a good run there, finally giving way to winter. As the Tribune reports on the 30th, the snow drove the party in from Crystal Springs. Territorial papers described the Worcester as palatial, with men's and women's toilet rooms, a central room for dining, sleeping, and lounging, boasting an upright piano, and a study for reading and writing. The buttery, we read, contains a complete set of china with the monogram WEC Company on all. This, dear listeners, is why they called it the Gilded Age. The comings and goings of such folk attracted attention. In 1886, the Tribune refers to the well-known Jerome Marble Party, naming the travelers on their annual shooting trip. That year, they hunted ducks at Buffalo on the way out, went to the Rockies for big game, and on the way back, stopped at Steele and Tappan for waterfowl. Other marble hunting cars came to Dakota, including the Edwin Forrest, the David Garrick, and the Yellowstone. Most of the traffic was on the Northern Pacific, but James J. Hill was reported to frequent Lakota with his car for waterfowling. The other repeat, much-noticed hunting car was the City of Saginaw, the vehicle of outdoorsman William B. Mershon. More next time about him.
That was Plainsfolk by NDSU Distinguished Professor of History, Dr. Tom Ezern. Weekly on Prairie Public, Tom airs stories from the Great Plains and the people who've shaped its history. And to hear more of his essays, visit prairiepublic.org.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Health Partners, offering a simplified approach to health plans, customer service, and community partnerships in North Dakota. Learn more at healthpartners.com/Dakota Plans.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and at a pecan orchard in Central Texas, the night shift belongs to bats. Instead of spraying chemicals, farmer Troy Swift relies on hundreds of these insect-eating mammals to protect his crop, a natural partnership that's proving both effective and sustainable. Reporter Michael Marks from Harvest Public Media takes us to Swift River Pecans in Lockhart, Texas, where science and nature are working hand in hand.
It's a clear September night on a bank above the San Marcos River in Central Texas, and a group of folks in headlamps are inspecting a small, noisy creature.
And this is very, very typical of this species. They got a lot to say all the time.
Researcher Melissa Donnelly is holding an evening bat in a cloth bag. It's tiny, no bigger than a clementine. She just caught it over the river in a super-sized tennis net, and now she's measuring it.
Yeah, and so I'm just holding on to the humerus so that I can get to the form.
Donnelly is a science specialist with the nonprofit Merlin Tuttle's Bat Conservation. One of the reasons she's collecting data on this bat is actually to help farmers grow better pecans, farmers like Troy Swift.
So our job is to work with Mother Nature instead of against her to grow the best pecans money can buy. That's the way we say it.
Swift's pecan orchard covers more than 250 acres. Lots of insects affect pecans, like moths and stink bugs, which bats love to munch. But when Swift first bought his orchard in 1998, he protected his trees the way everyone did, with plenty of chemicals.
Fungicide, insecticide, herbicide.
That started to change, though, after Swift met Merlin Tuttle in the mid-2000s. Swift first knew Tuttle as the guy he let fish on his property.
But then I found out he was a famous bat scientist.
Tuttle spent 65 years studying bats around the globe, including at Swift's orchard. Tuttle says you'd be hard-pressed to find better bat habitat.
If your orchard is near a river, you have a very good opportunity for attracting bats to bat houses.
Tuttle's been using the orchard to experiment with bat boxes, tweaking the color and position, even the kind of wood they're made with. Swift also runs a sawmill at his orchard where he makes lumber out of cypress trees. Turns out it's perfect for bat houses.
It's extra lightweight, extra insulative, and yet it's one of the longest lasting woods in America.
This punky cypress, as it's called, is porous on the inside, which gives the bats something to hold on to in the house. It also regulates temperature well, which is crucial for bats in hot places.
What we're doing is actually helping. We're not just giving the bats that are already there a place to live. We're building populations with more bats than there were previously.
There are dozens of bat boxes now on Swift's property, housing hundreds of bats. So many, in fact, Swift decided to just let them handle the bugs on part of his property this year.
This year is the first year I did not spray any insecticide at all. And guess what? We got a really good crop over there.
Reducing reliance on insecticides is one of Swift's big goals because of how they can harm ecosystems, human health, and a farmer's bottom line. Not every farm can do this, though. Russ Benedict is a biology professor at Central College in Iowa who studies bats in agriculture.
Primarily, I hear those in, you know, smaller operations, folks who are doing organic farming, that kind of stuff. Among the corn and soybean folks, I haven't really heard that much.
Bats need diversity in their diet, and they can't get it from a landscape that's just acres and acres of the same crop, according to Benedict. They don't thrive in wide open areas either, but for those farms where bats could make a difference, Troy Swift is ready to share what he's learned on his pecan farm.
I really want to have an impact on agriculture. This is not just pecans. Bats eat stink bugs and corn earworms, so that's good for all agriculture. And when you talk about mosquitoes and flies, it's also good for people. I mean, have you been bit by a mosquito since you've been here?
I had not. Neither had he. And for that, we could thank the bats. I'm Michael Marks, Harvest Public Media.
That was Michael Marks with Harvest Public Media, reporting from Lockhart, Texas. His story is part of a collaboration of public media newsrooms across the Midwest and Great Plains covering food, farming, and rural life.
The
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. In the last story in a three-part series about a nickel refinery in Oklahoma, KOSU's Sarah Lisi highlights what is at stake for those involved. The company trying to help secure the U.S.'s critical mineral supply chain and the tribal nations who oppose it.
All right, everybody, come on into the arena. Pour, dance your little hearts out. We got...
It's a hot July afternoon. Comanche tribal citizens and visitors are socializing and dancing at the Comanche Nation's annual homecoming powwow in southwest Oklahoma, about a 30-minute drive southeast of the tribe's headquarters in Lawton. Gatherings like this powwow are integral to sustaining Comanche culture. So is their Oklahoma homeland, says Forrest Tadanipa, the Comanche Nation's chairman.
Things like culture and language, we do our best to make them accessible to the diaspora, but you absolutely need to have people living together to have culture.
Kiowa, Comanche, and Apache, or KCA tribal nations, share a reservation.
We're permanent members of this community, right? We were here before, and now we're here now, and we hope to be here into the future.
Since Westwind Elements started pushing ahead with its plans to refine nickel, KCA tribal citizens fear what they stand to lose if the worst were to occur at the plant near their communities.
If, you know, there were an environmental catastrophe and it did have to cause people to kind of scatter, you know, that would then just be the slow death of the entire culture and language.
Transition minerals, such as nickel, can be used in rechargeable batteries and electric cars. In the long run, they can help combat climate change. Studies have found more than half of energy transition minerals are located on or near indigenous lands. Mining is dormant in southwest Oklahoma, and Westwind does not mine its own ores. However, it relies on mine product for its nickel refining process, which can turn fatal if not done correctly.
We already have so much global pessimism on us.
That's Kaylee Long, the CEO of Westwind Elements.
Why would you do it in the U.S.? It's the worst place to operate. Permitting's horrible. It's so expensive. So certainly, if we failed, it would further probably bolster the global sentiment that don't manufacture in the United States of America.
But Long wants to prove those skeptics wrong because she, too, has a lot at stake trying to operate America's first major nickel refinery.
Pretty much every dollar to my name. I'm the sole financial provider for my two children and me. There is no, you know, rich daddy or granddaddy waiting on me on the other side.
Long says her mission is to decrease the U.S.'s foreign reliance on critical minerals, which are crucial for the national economy and will minimize geopolitical risk. She hopes to clean up a notoriously dirty industry, ensuring ethical mining and environmental practices. But in many cases, indigenous people across the globe resist the critical minerals industry because it can disrupt and/or even destroy ecosystems and their ways of life. Christina Cooper runs the Comanche Nation's Office of Environmental Programs.
I think the concern will always be there just because of the hazards that are possibly there, and not necessarily just with Westwind, just Industrial Park as a whole.
Lawton houses a growing Goodyear tire manufacturing plant, paper factory, and a prospective rocket fuel company called Firehawk Aerospace, and of course, Westwind Elements, which recently entered into two sales purchase agreements totaling $1.7 billion in committed revenue. Cooper says despite concerns that Westwind is an environmental threat, it's meeting criteria. And no matter what happens, her department will continue to monitor the air and water quality to ensure the well-being of their community remains strong and healthy, because their culture depends on it. For KOSU, I'm Sarah Lisi.
This story is supported by the Earth Journalism Network and was the last in a series about the KCA community and Westwind Elements. To read and listen to the whole series, visit KOSU.org. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kuwanic Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Mm-hmm. soon, your computer could run on mushrooms. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Earlier this month, the World Meteorological Organization reported that greenhouse gases, including carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide, reached record levels in 2024, with CO2 increasing the most in 1 year since modern measurements began in 1957.
One of the larger contributors to carbon emissions in the U.S. is from meat consumption, which results in 329 million tons of gas being released, an amount nearly equal to that of burning fossil fuels.
A new study from the University of Michigan and the University of Minnesota shows the carbon hoofprint of thousands of U.S. cities, the greenhouse gas emissions per resident associated with meat consumption.
The researchers analyzed the effect that long supply chains of beef, pork, and chicken have on the environment, of which beef is the largest, and how it varies by city.
The team created an interactive map ranking the hoofprints of cities. New York had the largest, Los Angeles was second, and Miami third.
For example, Los Angeles gets beef from processing facilities in 10 different counties using cows raised in more than 450 counties, which in turn get feed from hundreds of other regions. Each step along the way has its own carbon footprint, like fertilizer to grow feed and transportation that can stretch for thousands of miles.
The team says that if Americans cut out half their beef consumption and switch to chicken, they could lower significant amounts of greenhouse gas emissions.
The solutions are not just about cutting out meat completely. Instead of eliminating something like pork from people's diets, cities could sponsor equipment for hog farmers like anaerobic digesters to reduce the environmental impact.
Cooks can make all sorts of dishes with shiitake mushrooms, from soups to risotto to stir-fry. But instead of using them in recipes, researchers at The Ohio State University have discovered a way to put them in computers.
The scientists say the fungi can be cultivated and trained to act as memristors, mimicking the functions of semiconductor chips. Memristors remember past electrical states and are integral to data processing.
The scientists cultured samples of shiitake and button mushrooms. After they were mature and dehydrated, they were connected to special electronic circuits and then electrified at various voltages and frequencies.
John LaRocco, the lead author, said in a release that the fungi can imitate actual neural activity, which means that there's no need for a lot of standby power when the machine is not being used, something that's a huge economic and computational advantage and friendly to the environment.
Conventional memristors require costly rare earth minerals and significant energy to produce, but these alternative organic options are more sustainable. West Nile virus wasn't common in Utah before 2003, but infections are starting to rise according to a new study from Utah State University.
The disease is transmitted by infected mosquitoes, in this case, the southern house mosquito, also known as quinx.
Populations of quinx are expanding into areas of Utah not seen before because of human development and climate change, which are creating favorable conditions for the insects to thrive.
Those findings don't surprise Bjorn Jaltesen. He found three mosquitoes in his garden in Iceland. Yeah, that Iceland. The last place you'd expect to find mosquitoes.
Jaltesen told the Iceland Monitor news site that he brought the specimens, two females and one male, to the Icelandic Institute of Natural History, which confirmed they were a species found in Europe and North Africa. He suspects the insects came aboard a container ship from a nearby port city.
As climate change accelerates and causes increased droughts, heat waves, floods, and rainfall, conditions for mosquitoes to breed and spread viruses are expanding into new areas at higher latitudes and altitudes.
The Arctic and Antarctic were places up until now where one would expect to avoid mosquito bites. Time will tell if the insects are able to gain a foothold and survive the winter as rising temperatures take the ice out of Iceland.
And finally, parents often turn to baby food to help infants get adequate nutrition early in life. But research out this week shows that a different set of youngsters could benefit too. Corals.
Scientists at University of Technology Sydney discovered that feeding coral larvae lipid supplements, including omega-3 rich oils, made it more likely they will survive and settle on reefs.
Coral reefs are threatened worldwide by warming oceans, and there are countless efforts to restore them, but it's been challenging to help young larvae succeed. Fewer than 1% of them typically make it past their first year.
Providing nutrition could give larvae a head start, supplying them with energy they need to swim and essential fats to help them grow and cope with stress.
The team is taking their findings from the lab to the Great Barrier Reef, where they will directly feed coral spawn in the area. The work will be carried out in partnership with local indigenous communities to support not only the next generation of corals, but also the next generation of reef stewards.
That's it for this week in water. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Kelly Corrigan Wonders. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 28th. In 1865, French historian and abolitionist Edward de Laboulaye proposed a monument to celebrate the upcoming centennial of American independence and the abolition of slavery. The project was delayed by the Franco-Prussian War, but finally got underway in 1875. The plan was for the people of France to fund the statue, while Americans would provide a site and build the pedestal. The statue stands as tall as a 22-story building. At the time it was erected, it was the tallest structure in New York City. The interior is made of cast iron and stainless steel. Its copper exterior was originally brown, but over the years, it developed the green patina we recognize today. The statue stands on a pedestal on what is now known as Liberty Island. Lady Liberty was dedicated by President Grover Cleveland on this date in 1886. It was designated as a national monument in 1924, and the National Park Service has lovingly cared for it since 1933. The statue's original name is Liberty Enlightening the World, but it's far better known as the Statue of Liberty. It quickly became a symbol of democracy and freedom. Thousands of immigrants passed the statue on their way to Ellis Island and knew they had come to a land of opportunity. It is so beloved, there are hundreds of replicas around the world. There are many here in the United States, too. In 1986, a Pennsylvania resident built a replica out of fiberglass and placed it on a rock in the Susquehanna River. It was meant to be temporary, but it quickly became a local legend and a tourist favorite. And it's still there. From 1949 to 1952, Boy Scout troops donated more than 800 8-foot-tall Statue of Liberty replicas to communities across the country. One of those statues found a home in Fargo. For years, she stood on a knoll in Island Park. In 1987, she was relocated to the intersection of Main Avenue and 2nd Street at the end of Veterans Memorial Bridge. Fargo's Lady Liberty was stolen in 2019 and disappeared. She's never been found, and some speculate she may have been thrown into the river. A new replica was installed the following year, this time with security cameras. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Meryl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
And that wraps up this Tuesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, it's our monthly philosophical currents discussion with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. When does something cross the line from wrong to illegal? In today's political world, that line is blurrier than ever. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to your joining us again.